Hello, I'm Steve Brunham with the Missing People podcast. In this program, my co-host Kelly Jolkowski, founder and president of Project Jason, talked with Sandy Hopkins, mother of missing Mike Hogan. Mike Hogan Sr. also participated in the conversation. Mike Hogan's been missing since May 16, 2005. He was last known to be in the area of Spring Lake Ranch in Cuttingsville, Vermont. Since that time, he was reported to have been seen in Ventura, California. Unfortunately, leads in that area haven't yet panned out. And now, let's listen to Kelly's conversation with Sandy and Mike Sr.
Welcome to the Missing People podcast. This is Kelly Jokowski, and our guests this evening are Sandy Hopkins and Mike Hogan Sr., parents of missing William Michael Hogan. Back on May 16th, 2005, Michael disappeared from his group home in Rutland, Vermont. So it's been a little over 2 years. Sandy, do you want to take us back to that day and tell us about what happened?
Sure. Michael was distressed over a situation with a friend. The friend was going to be leaving the group home, and Michael was sad about that. He went to work at Spring Lake Ranch, which where he had been working in the woods. When he came for lunch, to have lunch that day at the ranch, he never actually came in to the cafeteria. He was supposed to be answering the telephone, and someone came out to get him, and he said that he was having a bad moment and something to that effect. And they went back in, and when they looked out again, he wasn't there. Spring Lake Ranch is in Vermont, in a mountainous area, and there's quite a bit of property around. And because Mike, how many acres, Mike?
600 acres.
Yeah, and the lake. And because Michael had a tendency to go off by himself every once in a while, that was what the thinking was. And when the bus came to take everyone back to the group home, Michael was not there. So the people at the ranch proceeded to start a search, and that is when they contacted me and said that Michael was, you know, what had happened. At the time, I just thought, well, you know, he never ran away or anything, but I thought, well, he'll just show up this evening or tomorrow. And it just never occurred to me at the time that here we would be 2 years later and we haven't seen him since. I got a phone call earlier that afternoon before I knew he was missing, and it was on the other end of the phone was the sound of someone breathing, and I waited, and I said, hello, hello, and no one answered, and so I hung up, and I really feel to this day that was Michael on the other end of the phone. But of course, I had no idea that anything had happened at that time, and it never occurred to me that he would, you know, not say, hi, Mom, this is Mike, and we would have a conversation as we usually do. So that was the day, and and then as the evening wore on, I was becoming more and more stressed and worried and praying and hoping and really not knowing quite what to do, and really expecting that any moment the phone would ring and Michael would have been found. That was the day as I experienced it. Just certainly not as sad as the days that followed when the days and days were going by and we were not hearing from anything at all.
The realization kind of sets in then, would you say?
Yes, it does. It you know, days go by, and sometimes the longer it is, there are times when that becomes harder. A lot of grief, you know, people say time can heal, but you know, that like the 2 year, you know, back in May of this year, right around that time was a very difficult time for me, you know, worse than the days before, just thinking that I hadn't really even seen or spoken with my son in 2 years and wondering where he was and what he was doing and how he was. And it's just, you know, you just don't know, and your mind, you know, can just go a lot of places. I try to keep positive thoughts in there to get through.
Sure. Mike, did you find out that day that something was going on? Because I know that you both live in another state, so I'm not sure when, you know, you were both notified of the series of events that had occurred. What do you remember about that day?
I think Sandy called me and told me that Michael was missing, but I don't remember what day it was, whether it was that day or whether it was the next day. And I wasn't really that concerned because I thought, okay, he got into an argument with somebody, whatever, and he went off, and you know, he'll show up in either the next day or the day after. And then as time went on, I guess it was a Monday that he disappeared, and then Friday, Sandy and Michael's cousin went up to Vermont that weekend, and because were they doing a search that weekend, Sandy?
I think they had already done the search of the mountain, of the acres around. And
okay, so you weren't there when they did the search?
No.
Okay.
It just as the time was going by, and I became, you know, and nothing was happening. Mm-hmm. I just needed to get there. We ended up staying over a week, you know, there were leads here and there, but nothing materialized. And finally, I had to face the fact that I had to just come home without him. And I think that was also a very hard moment to be getting on that plane and not have him with me. And we, Mike and I together had been through that another time, which, you know, takes a year later. But it's very, very difficult when you travel with the hope, and then all of a sudden there you are returning home, and the precious person that you were hoping to see and have with you isn't there. So it's quite an up and down. The valleys are hard.
Absolutely. And you still don't have the answer. And I know, in fully understanding, it's just hard to believe that something like that could keep going on. You always think, well, you know, is this today, or is next week the day, or maybe next month is the day when you have the answer. Did law enforcement step up fairly quickly to help in the search?
I believe they did. When the people at the ranch couldn't find Michael in the normal places that they knew him to go, they called the police. And it was my understanding that the police reacted immediately and started searching the grounds and the roadway that leads up to the ranch. And that was, at least my impression, that was going on. And then that weekend that Sandy and Julie went up, they were passing out flyers in the town, and the press in the town, the Rutland Herald, I'm not going to think of the reporter's name, but he wrote a lot of articles about Mike, and there was a lot of publicity in the local newspaper about the search.
It's a relatively small town, and I guess that was a help in terms of, you know, not so much competition for the news. Alan Keyes was the reporter.
Alan Keyes, thank you.
Yeah, and I just stopped by with my niece, and he took the story and ran with it. And law enforcement was They were very quick to respond. The people at Spring Lake Ranch had done their own search several times, and then the police came, and they were very responsive. They went to Michael's home to look in there and interview people. I guess the way I would describe it is the first week or two, there was a lot of activity, and then there was this lull with law enforcement. And I went back up to Rutland with a search team from the Q Center with some scent dogs in the fall and met with law enforcement again. Of course, I'd been calling and doing everything, and Mike had been up there as well. And after that time, it seemed like they then got reengaged. And, you know, they've been really wonderful. I know that for a lot of the missing families, that it's been problematic with law enforcement and the media trying to get some exposure. For the most part, you know, I think we've been very fortunate in that regard. However, you know, it hasn't given us the results we had hoped for. And then there's some things that if we had known what to do right away, in retrospect, you read, okay, what do you do as soon as somebody's missing? There were a number of things that I would have done differently. And I think the one thing that stands out for me is when a missing person is reported, if someone would just hand you like these 10 steps and what you're supposed to do when you go to report that person missing, you know, it could make a big difference, you know, because first couple of days are just so critical in trying to locate. I mean, what we found in the fall when we went up with the search dogs, the consensus, you know, from the activity with that was that Michael, the last scent they had was Michael was headed out of Vermont. Once your loved one is out, you know, they're out from where you knew them to be the last time, the world is huge and they can be anywhere. And it sort of leaves you with this feeling of where to turn. So you just keep going back to the original place until something else presents itself.
So was it thought that he was walking along a road versus being in a wooded or mountainous area then?
When he left Rutland?
Where the scent dogs left off?
They said the last scent they had was he was in a vehicle, because they can differentiate from walking and being in a vehicle, and that he was in a vehicle and headed, you know, out of Rutland.
So we're thinking he either had somebody that he was friends with who drove him out of town, or he hitchhiked.
Tell us about Mike, and what do you miss most about him?
I miss not talking to him. Not we used to take walks and just talk and go to movies and go to restaurants and, you know, hang out together and just be together. I just miss not talking to him, not being in his company.
For me, it is, you know, Mike just mentioned not talking to him, that just the sound of his voice, not hearing his voice is just such an amazing loss. I spoke with him on the phone a few days before this happened. He called me, and I put him on the phone and he wanted to speak to his stepfather, Buddy, and he talked to him. And then Buddy handed me back the phone, and I, you know, and he said, well, I just wanted yours to be the last voice that I heard. And I don't put anything into that as though he was planning anything or at the time, but it was such a loving thing to say. And, you know, and I'll always remember that. He also had a wonderful laugh when he was feeling well. You know, he had a TV in his room, and he loved comedy. He, you know, was always, you know, anything that was, you know, a humorous. And, you know, we would just hear his laugh come out of the room, and it was, you know, it just made me happy just to hear it.
what's transpired since some of those initial searches and efforts with postering? And it sounds like, you know, you made one trip, and I made probably many trips back to Vermont since then. So what's happened over the course of 2 years?
Well, we went back to Vermont many times when there were leads. And just to follow up on the leads, you know, in person, rather than just leave it up to the police. And, of course, those leads never panned out. But it was a year later that I got a phone call from the Vermont State Police, the investigator who was in charge of Michael's case, who said that there was a lady in California in a place called Ventura, which is right on the ocean, and there were a lot of parks in the town, and this one park called Mission Park, this lady said that she met Michael and that he identified himself kind of piecemeal. First he said his name was Hogan, and then when they had conversation and they finished up with their conversation, she said something like, okay, Hogan, and he said, you can call me Mike.
So that sounds like that could have been him.
Well, we went out there. We got on the plane right away because the police were really convinced that this was him, that she had gone to Michael's website, and she said it was definitely, based on the pictures on the website, that it was definitely him. And so Sandy and I flew out there. The police in Ventura were great. They came to our place, our hotel, and took us all around the town and showed us where homeless people, were, what parks they hung out in, where they could get meals, either from Catholic Charities or from, I can't think of the other agency that was there. So we spent, and we did meet this lady. She was kind of mysterious. She wouldn't tell us her name. She said, just call me Star, and that she was a homeless advocate, that she, you know, went through the parks and gave them sandwiches or cookies or whatever, and she had a rapport with them, and she said that she didn't want to reveal her name because she had this relationship with the homeless and that the homeless did not trust the police, so she didn't want them to find out that she was talking about one of them, to the police. In fact, I don't think she ever had any direct contact with the police. She went through a friend of hers who was willing to say, you know, who she was, what her name was. And anyway, we met with her, and she was very convincing. We believed that, you know, this person was a legitimate person and not a crackpot or somebody who was trying to, make headlines or whatever. But the police were very supportive of us. They helped us out tremendously. And this lady and her friend really worked hard. The press in the town of Ventura did a story. They sent a photographer and a reporter to go with us to go on various searches. It was wonderful. We went up to the next big city, I guess, from Ventura, which was Santa Barbara, where they had a television station, and they put us on television. There was an art council in Santa Barbara that did art shows on the weekends, and they made copies of Michael's flyer, and they had all of the people who participated, which I think were maybe 100 artists, would display their work on the beach in Santa Barbara. So they had them all have flyers with Michael's picture on it. But, you know, after 8 days, we came up with nothing.
We were pretty insistent. I mean, in terms of, Mike was handling one part and searching, and I was trying to get the media piece, and, you know, and it wasn't like it just happened, but it wasn't real difficult. The TV station, basically, they said no, that they had a deadline and they couldn't do it, and the receptionist, we started talking to her after the producer left, and she said, just sit down there, and when so-and-so walks by, tell them your story. And we did, and someone else came through, another producer, and we talked to him, and he told us to be back there that evening, and he would do the story. So, you know, we were persistent and very active. The thing that I noticed, and it's just that law enforcement is really not set up to look for the missing. You know, the case, it was a Vermont case. So when we went out to California, there really wasn't anybody in charge, even though the people were very nice and took us around. But as the days went by, people went on and off shift, and we just really didn't have anyone to contact. The officer we met when we got there, we never saw again. And when the leads started coming in, I think they were sort of astonished, and they came as a result of the press. What we were used to was being kept informed from Vermont about this lead came in, and their approach to it really was, we'll let you know when we find anything. For law enforcement, that seems to be a reasonable, you know, approach from their end, but it's not when you're the family of the missing. I mean, you just want to know, is there anything going on, and actually, you know, get involved. The Q Center was very instrumental in handling the leads because they had to go out to different law enforcement agencies, because you have your sheriff's office, and then depending on where the lead came from, it was a different law enforcement agency that would handle it. So it was rather complicated, and finally the Q Center, not finally, but fairly quickly, stepped in and did a lot of the relaying of the information because they were also getting calls. So, you know, it had its, you know, I think, as I said about Vermont, we were very fortunate in the press that we got and the cooperation, and yet there were still things that made it difficult to, you know, because the world just isn't set up to look for missing adults. And Michael was listed as endangered because he was on some medications, and it's still very, very, very difficult to, you know, to get people's attention in this world because they're bombarded with so many other priorities. But
yeah, Mike isn't a child, he's a man.
Yeah.
And they tend to discount, you know, I mean, certainly when a child gets off a school bus and that's the last time they see the child, that gets a lot of press and gets a lot of, you know, immediate reaction. But in Michael's case, it wasn't like that. He was 28 years old, and as far as they searched in Vermont. They had a search, an initial search with dogs and a search and rescue team, and then I think all told they had searched the 600 acres of the ranch with these search and rescue, and then you have the people from the Q Center that went up there with their dogs too. But the Vermont State Police and their search and rescue volunteers, their professionals, they've searched that area around the ranch, I know, four different times. So, and I was there the second time that they searched, and that was an all-day operation, and I saw how they operated. And they had a command center with a huge trailer with all these antennas sticking out of it. And I saw how all of the searchers had GPS monitors and their own dogs. It was a very professional operation. Of course, in Ventura, it was just word of mouth going around to the different police officers. And when the shifts would change over, supposedly they were briefed on, you know, what we were there for. It wasn't like it was in Vermont, but I was still appreciative of their efforts and their concern.
He was confused when he, according to the woman who called, she said he was confused. He said he was trying to get home. He knew his mother was looking for him, but he wasn't sure where he lived. And
yeah, he said he lived someplace on the East Coast. Was it south of New York, but he didn't remember the name of the state. He couldn't remember Sandy's phone number, which was really unusual because Mike had a real gift for remembering numbers. If you told him a number, it would stick in his head, and he could he'd repeat it. And certainly he was familiar with my phone number and Sandy's phone number.
Did it help to some extent that even though you didn't bring him home and you expected to bring him home, that you had all this support from strangers? Did that help keep you going? And if not, what did keep you going? What did enable you to deal with the fact that you expected to bring him home and you didn't?
Well, from my point of view, I was encouraged because I believed that he was there. I believed this woman, and you know, we have relatives who live out there, both on both sides of the family. I have a niece who lives just on the other side of water from San Francisco. Michael's cousins from Sandy's side of the family, Jeff and Tim, they live in that area too. And Sandy's husband, Buddy, has relatives who live in San Diego area, Los Angeles area, right, Sandy?
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah.
And so I felt like we've got this network. And I went back out there a couple of months later just to follow up. We had made a lot of friends when we were there, and everybody, you know, said that they were going to, you know, keep an eye out for him. And so going out there a second time was actually very depressing, because when you're there with, you know, when Sam and I were there together, we had each other to bounce things off of. And then when you go someplace and you're by yourself, it's just you and there's nothing to bounce anything off of. So I really felt that second trip was a downer for me. When I went to Ventura, I had actually gone out to Oakland and visited with my niece, and then drove down from Oakland to Ventura. So I wound up not staying very long in Ventura because it was just a very depressing experience, and I turned around after a couple of days and came back to Oakland and spent some time with my niece, and then flew back home. So that second trip was a real bummer, I have to admit.
And it's certainly a good example of why family and friend support is so important.
Yeah.
This concludes the first section of Kelly's interview with Sandy and Mike Sr. You're listening to the Missing People podcast, copyright 2007, all rights reserved and held jointly by the Missing People podcast and Project Jason. Original music created and performed by Ariana Kima. For more information on Project Jason, please go to projectjason.org. To learn more about Missing Mike Hogan, please go to helpfindmikehogan.org. For my co-host, Kelly Jolkowski, I'm Steve Bronham with the Missing People podcast. Thank you for listening.